Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, the heavily caffeinated Greg Everett on the other side of the mountains. This is episode 125 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what's going on?
Well, I'm actually mildly caffeinated at this point, but my caffeination levels will be increasing throughout the duration of the show.
Outstanding. Cool. So,
as they do every time, of course.
It's the only way that we don't pass into a catatonic state, which I suspect probably happens to a lot of our listeners, too. So
that's okay.
So what's new? What's exciting?
Well, the little ebook I talked about last time is out.
The little ebook that
well.
Could.
Thank you nice. Guys very much.
Nice. And remind folks what that is and where they can find it.
It is The Portable Greg Everett.
Sweet.
It's,
which that's a hard thing to find.
7 years of articles.
You're kind of large, so.
Yeah. Well, that's why we made this little PDF version.
Nice, nice.
Although there was already a joke on Twitter about something like, is that Greg Everett in your pocket or are you just happy to see me? And the hashtag was big pockets.
Boom, bang. that was Amy Kubel that did that one, right?
Was it? Yes.
Yeah. Amy can be a card at times. She's a sharp little biscuit, little biscotti.
Excellent.
Yeah. What else? So, by the time this show goes up, theoretically, the new robwolf.com should be live. We might have this new thing called Rob TV rolling, which is a video show. We'll see what type of train wreck that is. But
are you going to wear costumes for each episode?
You know, I really wanted to do it like David Lee Roth. Next on Dave
TV. Oh, my God. That would be so incredible. Either that, you can go back between Dave TV and Max Headroom.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool. That would be cool. But I just don't really have the depth of bench in my my wardrobe. I mean, it's pretty much like t-shirts and sweatshirts. So that would get boring pretty quick. So we'll see. Well, but should have a new site. Should have the Rob TV thing rolling, which should deal more with kind of food politics and kind of newsy pieces. So I can be a little bit more like reactive and on the pulse of news topics. So we'll see how that goes. And as of yesterday, we were 5 weeks out from the Wolf Cub arriving. So getting close, man.
Whew. Are you freaking out or what?
Alternating bouts of terror and excitement, which I hear is a sign of a rational, healthy individual. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would qualify that as pretty normal.
Yeah. So that's cool. That's what I've got.
Yeah.
I guess we should do a podcast, huh?
Let's do this
motor
podcast.
Right through this. Cool.
Steve says, I heard someone once quote you as saying that until one reaches optimal body composition, the fat they have on their body is enough to keep them fueled and that this is optimal for fat loss. If that's true, what's the practical application? No additional fat in my diet, olive oil, avocado, nuts, etc. Do I just eat paleo but keep everything lean and clean?
So, yeah, the deal with this is just it. If you want really quick fat loss, this is a good way to go, in which you follow that rule of about a gram of protein per pound of body weight, which what that's going to do is provide enough protein substrate, enough branched-chain amino acids to really minimize muscle loss when you're in a calorie-restricted state. You might even throw in something like some branched-chain amino acids, 30 or 40 grams a day of some branched-chain amino acids on top of that to really make a stopgap of preventing muscle mass loss. Because when we're leaning out, that it's kind of nice to come out the back end of that with as much fat lost and as little muscle lost as we can possibly do. And that's why we recommend some resistance training and stuff like that. But then within that, what this is recommending is just kind of, it's not that you have to be totally neurotic about it. You know, like if you're cooking some scrambled eggs, you can throw some olive oil in a pan to cook them or some coconut oil or something like that. But it's just this acknowledgement that we would like a little bit of a calorie restriction. We would like to probably control insulin pretty powerfully. So we might limit carbs a little bit, and that'll be based on what your activity level is and some stuff like that. But then if we just keep the overall calorie content kind of modest, induce a little bit of a calorie deficit in addition to controlling hormonal balance and then making sure that we're in as anabolic a state as we can by eating plenty of protein, then we should have this kind of body recomposition kind of gig, to steal a line from Lyle McDonald. You know, we ideally are maintaining muscle mass as best as we can, losing body fat, and this is from inducing a little bit of a calorie deficit. And this is in contrast to where you're going to be in kind of a maintenance phase, and this is assuming that you're active, where you're actually going to increase the level of fat intake to, or potentially carbs, but again, this is kind of dependent on your activity level and all that stuff. But you're probably going to ratchet total calorie intake up to some degree once you hit your goal weight. We don't need the calorie restriction anymore. We want to start chasing some performance and stuff like that. And so, you know, you're going to ratchet the calories up. And so it's just, you know, being modest with the amount of fat intake so that you can accelerate the fat loss, induce more of a calorie restriction. I think even Lyle McDonald has a really pretty austere program where basically he's recommending, apologies if I get this wrong, I haven't read his stuff in a bit, but, you know, where he will recommend a really high protein intake, you know, that gram and a half of protein per pound of body weight or somewhere around there, and basically like no carbs, no fat in addition to that. And or very, very little, you know, just whatever is kind of flying with the protein source. And so you're inducing a really severe calorie restriction, but you're trying to maintain muscle mass as best you can by a very high protein intake. And you're still going to lose some muscle mass. You're going to feel like absolute dog shit on this protocol, but you can lean out really, really quickly. So it kind of just depends, you know, how much suffering you're willing to do and, like, you know, how compelling of a situation it is for you to get leaned out, or maybe you do that for a couple of days to kind of kickstart the process or something like that. It's not something I really recommend for the long haul. And if you've had a wacky relationship with food, I don't really recommend that at all. We need to reestablish just some normal eating patterns, but that's the story on the quote low fat paleo.
Man. That's a little bit skinny. That's like 900 calories a day for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's
that's like the zone for a 12-year-old girl.
Right. It's gnarly, but, you know, I mean, it's just kind of a step up from a protein sparing modified fast kind of gig.
Well, so then let me ask you this, because I'm sure this question will come up. What credence is there to the idea that dietary fat will actually help shift you into a better body fat burning setup?
You know, there's legitimacy to that, but it when you start consuming fat, then you upregulate the enzymes in the cellular pathways that use fat as a fuel source. Like that's absolutely true. But at the end of the day, if you're in a calorie restricted state, and also a carbohydrate restricted state, that's going to happen anyway. There's a great paper, and I really need to remember to put this in the science section of the new site. It is impossible to determine if you look at somebody in a ketogenic state, it's impossible to tell. You know, you look at blood lipids or, you know, whatever you want to look at, it's impossible to tell whether or not they are fasting, basically calorie restricted and accessing body fat for energy, versus eating an isocaloric or even to some degree a hypercaloric ketogenic diet. Both of them are going to induce lipolysis. It's going to induce fat burning. But the reality is that an isocaloric or hypercaloric ketogenic diet is going to maintain or possibly even accrete, say, like muscle mass. And it's going, you know, you might have some fat loss under that circumstance, but there's no doubt that a calorie restricted ketogenic diet is going to pull fat mass off of people like gangbusters. And there's some arguments back and forth that you don't necessarily, you know, ketosis isn't the most important part, that you just need some calorie restriction and then maintain muscle mass but via adequate protein, and so you can tackle this with the higher carbohydrate intake. And I think that's true. There, you know, different people will respond different ways. But even then, and, you know, like the zone is a good example of that. And this is a funny thing, actually. Back in the day, like there was a website that Mauro Di Pasquale, like all the anabolic diet, metabolic diet guys would hang out on. And the zone nut swingers would hang out on there. And they were claiming that the process of going on a calorie restricted zone was a non-ketogenic event. And the dudes on Mauro Di Pasquale's site, you know, he's the guy that developed the anabolic diet and the metabolic diet and stuff like that. And those dudes knew their nutritional biochemistry way better than Barry Sears and the folks that were recommending the zone. And they established clearly and immediately that even at a carbohydrate intake level as recommended by the zone, if you're in a calorie deficit state, you're going to be producing ketone bodies and stuff like that. And that's just kind of going kind of nutso down the rabbit hole. But what I tend to find at the higher carbohydrate levels is just that people are hungry. Whereas if we're in a legit ketogenic diet, a ketogenic state, people tend to be both calorie restricted and not all that hungry, which is kind of this holy grail of getting people to not be overweight and just get them to lean out, because it's pretty damn hard to run around hungry and actually deal with all that stuff. So Mike Eads, Dr. Eads, his website is just thick with studies and kind of commentary on this notion that you could be down in that Ansel Keys kind of starvation study level of calorie restriction, 1,500 calories, but it's ketogenic and you're not really all that hungry, especially compared to a higher carbohydrate intake.
Well, what do you know?
Craig's like, I'm so so sad I asked that question. So
all right, let's move over to a different fat question.
Indeed.
Jeff says, I have been paleo since December 5th, 2011. That's a very precise date. I ran across an article called Obesity in the Paleolithic Era. The article basically compares some skinny and fat artifacts and concludes that obesity existed in the Paleolithic Era. What are your thoughts? And there's no link to the study.
You know what? Squatchy gave us the link in the original email. So, and just as an aside, if you guys have been liking the podcast more, probably mainly due to Squatchy and him actually doing a really good job sifting through the emails. Greg and I were completely overwhelmed with that, and it was kind of a grab bag of stuff. And Chris actually reads all of this and tries to get interesting questions. So shout out to Squatchy for doing what I think is a fantastic job on the podcast triage and whatnot. So there was a link to that, and maybe we could dig that up and put it in the show notes. But it kind of a interesting research paper looking at these figurines, these Venuses that are made from the lower Paleolithic era, and they're definitely quite obese and these idealized forms. My thought on that, when we look in the literature with humans, with mice, with most critters, there is a certain frequency of a obesity gene that almost regardless of caloric intake, these individuals are quite obese. And so I think that we're just seeing folks from, our hunter-gatherer past that probably expressed this very potent obesity genotype and phenotype. And that was something that was pretty novel in that time. And it was kind of held up as this almost kind of miraculous kind of event. It's interesting when you look through history. I want to say Greg will probably remember this better than me, but like Julius Caesar was epileptic. And
I don't remember that at all.
You don't remember? Okay. he was epileptic, and when he would go into a seizure, they thought that he was like communing with the gods, and it was held up as a really powerful, amazing thing. It wasn't viewed as a disability. It was considered to be this kind of communing with the gods kind of gig. And so I think that we could easily assume that, obesity was probably not the norm in the Paleolithic, for a variety of reasons. When we look at contemporary hunter-gatherers, that seems to be the stuff that we find. But I don't think it's surprising at all that you would see some outliers pop up, and that when those outliers did pop up, that was probably kind of this miraculous event for them, and that's where this all came in. And so obviously that's all reasonably unscientific. There's not a lot of test tube type data that we can support that. It's a lot of opinion, but it makes sense as far as I can put together a reasonable argument, I guess. Greg, any thoughts on chubby figurines from the lower Paleolithic?
Well, Yeah, kind of. I mean, not particularly deep thoughts, but it seems to me. I guess I'm confused about what this article is trying to prove. And I did just find that link, so we'll put that in the notes. But without having read it, I mean, are they trying to claim that because there were a few Chubsters back then that, you know, the kind of eating they were doing is not good? Like, I'm a little confused about what they're
I don't know. They weren't really drawing any type of conclusion from it other than just talking about the fact that this stuff existed. Like, this was not a they didn't make any statements one way or the other on that. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was like the Airplane Magazine kind of article.
Right. Right.
Okay. Behçet's disease.
There we go.
And through our extensive research, we've discovered that that is the proper Turkish pronunciation of this disease.
And you know what went down with that was that Greg asked me, hey, how do you pronounce this? And then I forwarded to him a link to this thing. Let me Google that for you. So no, that's actually not true. Greg actually knew about this cutting-edge search engine called Google and even managed to track one down that had a pronunciation key, you know, one of the search terms on this. So
pretty amazing. Good with the old Google machine over here.
Amazing.
All right. Dave says, hi, Rob. I have been on the paleo lifestyle for a year now and has been life-changing. I work at a very active job as a heli-ski guide. It's a great job but can be hard on the body. No complaints, though. My joint pain has decreased as well. I'm more alert and I don't get sick as frequently as before. Writing you is not for me, but is for my wife. I have slowly been converting my family to paleo. This first step has been getting the family off gluten. I'm wanting to get some information from my wife on Behçet's disease, which she has been diagnosed with. There's not a lot of information on it, and her doctor is skeptical on the paleo diet, which is quite frustrating at times. I know there is info on your site on autoimmune disease, but was wondering if you have any specifics for Behçet's, such as diet and supplement recommendations, as well as lifestyle or exercise recommendations. She has a lot of questions, and I'm happy she's open to paleo, but want to give her as much info as possible to help with her health. Thanks for everything, and hopefully you or somebody can help us out.
Gosh, you know, Behçet's is obviously an autoimmune disease. You know, I mean, so there's that piece. And then this is... I don't know. Maybe I'll throw this out to the listeners. Like, how do we effectively communicate this idea that? And like, I'm assuming folks have read the book, and I feel like I've made this case that there's a common etiology to all autoimmune diseases. It's related to intestinal permeability. There's a variety of things that could be involved with that: grains, legumes, dairy, alcohol, acetaminophen. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that could feed into permeable gut. There's the FODMAPs that lead into a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and that may be kind of a problem in this too. But how do we just, you know, as a blanket statement, or maybe this is something that we just kind of have to revisit again and again, these autoimmune diseases have a common etiology related to intestinal permeability. The solution appears to, in broad brushstrokes, be eat a, you know, autoimmune protocol paleo diet. I think episode 68, we had Matt Lalonde on and we talked a bunch about that. If you go into the frequently asked questions, we have a brief description, but it's completely adequate. It's brief, but thorough, of what you want to do to modify a basic paleo approach to make it autoimmune protocol. You want to make sure that your vitamin D levels are up, that your sleep is good, that you're not exercising to exhaustion. But, you know, my thing with this is that we're finding the same results again and again and again, right? Whether it's like scleroderma, whether it's multiple sclerosis, whether it's narcolepsy, all of these things have autoimmune underpinnings to them. If we can get people eating something close to an autoimmune protocol paleo diet, get their vitamin D levels up, maybe take a little bit of fish oil, get some more sleep, we're finding that this stuff either goes into remission completely or it is dramatically improved. You know, like the Dr. Terry Wall's multiple sclerosis talk that she did for the TED Talks, like that's an N equals one, but we're starting to get thousands of people with these responses. And so, you know, for the doc in this, the whole like skepticism of the paleo diet, like I don't know if I'm just getting older and cranky, but you know, I mentioned Dr. Amy Myers on the show last time, and she made this point that people who are undergoing you know, their doctor is investigating whether or not they're gluten intolerant, and then the doctor will recommend that they eat gluten so that they can get a positive gluten, you know, response on a test. And I guess that's all nice for insurance companies and stuff like that. But she made the point that she thought that that was paramount to malpractice, because we know how incredibly terrible gluten is for people, particularly in this, you know, legitimate celiac spectrum. And I think it's pretty terrible for damn near everybody. And so within all this stuff, you know, it's like, if you are a practicing physician and you can't wrap your head around this, like, evolution via natural selection, Darwinian medicine being a vector in discerning what the heck is going on with people, it's kind of a what the fuck point with this. You know, it's like, we need to get a little bit better than this. You know, this skepticism is born at 100% out of ignorance. I know we kind of need to be patient and just keep putting the message out there and don't burn bridges and all this rest of that stuff. But it gets a little frustrating sometimes. I guess 15 years of hammering, donging on this, you're kind of like, okay, folks, we can do better than this. You know, and especially when what we're recommending is a basic nutritional protocol that involves, like, you know, lean or grass-fed meats, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds. You know, it's like, so somebody's going to die in a month of doing this, and you're skeptical about it. It gets me a little fired up. So completely rambling here. For your wife, all I can say, like, I've been contemplating a blog post on how do I convince people to eat paleo, which I don't really know how you convince people to eat paleo. Like, the greasy used car salesman pitch that we have is give it a shot for 30 days and see what happens. And if the person doesn't have some spark of desire to change that is sufficient enough to get them to eat a damn paleo diet for 30 days, then to some degree they're beyond help. And for this doctor, you know, they're super busy. They don't get paid as much as what they used to. They got to deal with a ton of paperwork. And so it's, I won't say a rare physician that will read this stuff, but it's not, you know, an everyday occurrence. And so this is where you guys just have to take responsibility for your own health. And you have to decide if you're going to try this thing on and really give it a shot. I would be shocked if you didn't get some results. I would be really interested to hear what the results are one way or another. And for your wife, like, again, the greasy used car salesman pitch is give it a shot for 30 days. How do you look, feel, and perform? Track some biomarkers of health and disease before and afterwards. And the worst case scenario is that you didn't eat some cookies and some French bread for 30 days and you're no better, or maybe, you know, who knows, maybe you're worse. We haven't seen that happen yet, but, you know, maybe that's the possibility. But 30 days later, we're going to know whether or not this paleo intervention was good, bad, or indifferent for your condition. And I guess it just kind of boils down to how motivated are you to actually give that a shot? Like, I can't think of much more of a sales pitch than that. And then there was the original question, do we have something specific to Bichet's or Bichette's? What's our standard on this now?
Bichette's.
Bichette's, that's right. It's the Chet, because it reminded me of Chet from Weird Science. So, okay, cool.
So not that your wife reminds
no, Chet, but just the term.
So we're clear.
Yeah, just to be clear.
So I think it's, you're right. It's super tough. How do you convince someone to do anything, really? If they don't want to do it to some degree, then you probably aren't going to be able to convince them without force. But I think the two biggest hurdles between the lay person and their doctors are getting over the fear of eating that much meat and the fear of not eating healthy whole grains.
Right.
Right. If you can figure out a way to convince people that 1 month of eating meat and not eating their sprouted wheat toast won't kill them, then maybe they'll be a little more open to it.
Yeah, and you know, within that, so here's what we're recommending. Instead of eating the sprouted wheat toast, which has almost no nutrient content, the main nutrient content that comes from the bulk of that stuff is because it's fortified. Like, we're taking synthetic nutrients and sticking it in there, because otherwise we end up with a bunch of deficiency diseases.
So you might as well eat white bread at that point.
Exactly. But, you know, the insane recommendation that we're making is eat some yams or sweet potatoes, fruits or vegetables in lieu of eating that.
That's crazy.
That's the insane recommendation that we're making. So, this is something that pops up a ton, and there may not be like a broad brushstrokes way of dealing with this, but, you know, I just kind of want to put it out to folks, if someone has a condition that is known or suspected to be autoimmune, again, go back to the Google gig, you know, like Google paleo diet and bichettes, and see if there's anything. Chances are there's not anything yet. Like, we're in the beginnings, the Wild West of this stuff, and there's not a lot of things that we have something solid on. You know, we've got a little bit on narcolepsy. We've got a lot more on, like, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and stuff like that. But I guess my recommendation is once we're in that autoimmune realm, I would look at it less as a unique snowflake kind of scenario and just understand there's a common etiology with all these autoimmune diseases. We seem to be experiencing a remarkable improvement in the symptoms of these autoimmune diseases when people follow the standard autoimmune paleo protocol. And so what I would ask you to do is just give it a shot and then give us feedback about what you did and collect as much data on this as you can. Take photos before and afterwards, do blood work before and afterwards, and then we've got a legitimate data point. So if, Dave, if you can rope your wife into doing this for 30 days, track some really good biomarkers on this, and then we'll know one way. Even if it doesn't work, it's like then we've got a data point that says, okay, this didn't work for this person. What did she do? Well, it didn't look like she added vitamin D to the mix. The next person will really make sure that we hammer on them to add vitamin D to the mix, and then maybe they get an improved response to that. And it is that science and a double-blind, placebo-controlled, crossover, gold standard, means? No, it's not. But I think it's still some worthwhile information. It's kind of like combinatorial chemistry. We've got a bunch of different reactions going on in a bunch of different vessels, and this is a way that we can really accelerate the learning on this stuff. And at the end of the day, my main thrust on this is just giving people some alternatives for tackling their treatment in an effective way besides like methotrexate and immunosuppressants, which will kill you eventually. You will die from some complication associated with that. Nikki's mom died from complications due to rheumatoid arthritis about 3 months before I met Nikki. And since that point, we've interacted with literally like thousands of people that have put rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis symptoms into remission by basically just changing their diet, getting more sleep, and taking some vitamin D. And so my main thrust is just getting people to give this a shot and then say, hey, if they bump into somebody that's got an autoimmune disease, it's like, hey, there's this website. It's got a free protocol. Give it a shot and then give the dude some feedback. Like that's all I'm asking here is that we create an alternative opportunity or alternative view on this so that folks don't just have to suffer through the conventional treatment, which really doesn't do anything for.
Indeed. Okay. Let's...
I managed to just put down some more coffee, so I'm even more fired up. So
awesome. I know. My cup's sitting here empty. And
my cup's
starting to get a little nervous.
Do you want to run over and fill it up?
Nah, I'm good. Okay. I'll sneak over while you're blathering away on this
perfect,
next one.
Perfect. Good call.
The pod is literally 6 feet from where I'm sitting. Oof. So
that's a long walk for an Olympic lifter, though.
Well, my chair has wheels.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So okay, cool.
It's not 6 walking feet. It's
six linear feet. Nice.
Simple machines, Rob. Come on.
Nice.
This we may be eating Paleolithic, but we are fully Neolithic when it comes to machinery.
Good man.
Okay, Sean says, hey guys, insert gratuitous praise and stroking here. Seriously though, toot toot. I don't know what that means. Is that good?
It sounds good to me. I like okay. Toot toot. I mean it.
My wife and I were convinced to attend a, quote, free dinner at my mother-in-law's house, courtesy of Salad Master. Man. After a couple hours of semi-misguided nutrition advice paired with an okay meal, the scare tactics made their appearance. They performed a, quote, pot test. I think Rob performed a lot of those, too. Spouted some unsupported rhetoric and showed us just how bad every pot and pan that wasn't made from their titanium was for our health. This was followed by the sales pitch for their exorbitantly priced cookware. So now my question, how close to the truth are these salesmen? I've read plenty of bad things about Teflon, but what about stainless steel or cast iron? How about porcelain enamel? Have you done any research on the various cookware surfaces? I'm assuming that the more inert is better. So have you seen research that supports one surface over the others? Thanks in advance for hopefully keeping $1,000 pots and pans out of my kitchen.
Oh, man. You know, when we moved to Reno, prior to that, we had been pretty much existing on just a random assortment of cooking stuff. I mean, it really looked like a gypsy yard sale or something like that. Like, it was pretty rough. And I started giving some thought to, like, the halogenated hydrocarbons and Teflon peeling off in my food and doing some sort of untoward stuff to me. And so we ended up buying some all-clad, which isn't the titanium cookware, but it's pretty pricey cookware. We ended up getting some Le Creuset, which is some enamel cookware. That stuff is pretty non-reactive. Like, you know, people will make an argument that you're going to get some cadmium out of the all-clad, which I just kind of shrug on that. But, you know, here's the deal. Like, I still have some high quality Cathalon nonstick skillets because when I cook eggs, I just don't have the patience or the time to every single time I get ready to cook in my all-clad to get the oil at the exact correct temperature so that the egg, like 80% of it, doesn't glue to the bottom of the pan. And so for me, when I cook like some eggs over medium, which is the way I eat my eggs most of the time, I throw some coconut oil in the pan. I cook on a real low temperature. And if I'm getting some halogenated hydrocarbons from that, then I'm just going to freaking deal with it. So I for me, if I'm cooking like a soup, a stew that's kind of acidic, I throw it in the enameled Le Creuset pot. Even then, I'm not all that freaked out about it. You know, like I'll throw stuff in the all-clad, even if I have like tomato juice in it, and I throw in some vinegar in there to break down the meat a little bit and stuff like that. Like, I'm just not that concerned. Like, the fact that we drive in cars and we have, like, you know, plastic carpet that's outgassing, you know, xenoestrogens and everything, I think that there's probably bigger fish to fry elsewhere, and that's as far down the rabbit hole as far as neuroses that I want to go with my cookware. So I think that you could make an argument to have like some high quality Cathalon stuff for like the really delicate nonstick cooking, and then for the rest of your stuff, like you're cooking a steak or something, I would use like a Le Creuset or a all-clad or a Le Creuset pan for that type of stuff. You could go Matt LaLonde on everything and cook it at a real low temperature over a long period of time, which I think that makes sense, unless, you know, yeah, like Nikki really likes a little bit of a scald on her meat. And so, you know, low temperature cooking is just not going to happen in that case. So I don't know that you really need $1,000 pots and pans to avoid the worst baddies out of the you know, xenoestrogens and metals and all that stuff.
I just microwave everything in cheap plastic containers.
And then if you just take some Arimidex on top of that, then it just prevents the estrogen from doing anything to you. So you're totally good to go.
See? Oh, man. See, modern solutions, right?
Revolutionary solutions to modern problems. Yeah, something like that.
Something.
That was okay. Another good Chevy Chase movie, Modern Problems.
Man, I miss Chevy Chase.
He was cool.
I think honestly, that is my earliest Saturday Night Live memory, is him falling down the stairs in the audience. He was the best.
Yes. Then he got grumpy.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to be nice in real life.
That's true.
I don't hang out with a guy to see him when he's doing funny stuff on TV.
That's true.
Okay. Julia says, "Hi, Rob and Greg. I'm a family physician and want to thank you for all that you have done to spread the word about the paleo diet. I've been paleo for 2 months, but I've been recommending the diet to my patients with chronic disease for much longer. I finally took the plunge myself as a New Year's resolution to, quote, walk the walk with my patients, and 2 weeks ago I started CrossFitting. During the prior 2 years, I followed a gluten-free Weston A. Price Foundation diet, including lots of good meats and vegetables, but also soaked grains/legumes, accompanied by a lot of chronic cardio. I had a healthy baby 4 months after my second, or excuse me, 4 months ago after my second uneventful pregnancy. I feel better than ever since finally making the transition to paleo and cutting the cardio. Acne and eczema are gone. Nasal congestion is better. Lots of energy despite still getting up a couple times a night to nurse the baby, etc. So to get to the point, I obviously no longer follow the Weston A. Price diet, but I have been adapting a lot of Weston A. Price recipes to paleo versions. My question is about the Weston A. Price recommendations to use Montmorillonite clay. Quote, azomite. Excuse me. is also known as azomite powder. As a mineral supplement and sports drink after exercise. I have always been intrigued by the sports drink recipe in Sally Fallon's Nourishing Traditions. God, when I trip up on one word, I can't read for the rest of the question. Indeed. But I've never made it because, frankly, eating clay seems completely unnecessary and more than a little risky. I know geophagy is common in other cultures, particularly in pregnant women. Dr. Google says that clay taken – I'm totally stealing that from you, by the way – says that clay taken internally is said to have potent detoxification properties given its high cation exchange capacity. Man, you're killing me on this one. And also is rich in trace minerals. But I have yet to see an evidence-based source for this information. We are, of course, taught in medical school that pica in the form of clay or soil ingestion is to be strictly discouraged, particularly among pregnant women, given the risk of heavy metal poisoning. However, the fact – I don't know why the term heavy metal poisoning always makes me laugh. It sounds like a big show.
It's like the day on the green, like Metallica, Guns N' Roses, and Body Count, which was amazing, by the way.
Oh, man. However, the fact that the practice exists in so many traditional societies makes me wonder what the real benefit-to-risk ratio is, and if geophagy had a place in Paleolithic times as well. I'm aware of the research showing that dietary clay can bind to aflatoxin in animals and humans, as well as studies that have found heavy metal contamination in clays in certain geographic areas, but I'm unaware of any studies showing clear benefit from a detox or mineral supplementation standpoint, or on the flip side, showing clear in vivo toxicity from ingesting clay. Are you aware of any additional research supporting or discouraging its internal use? All right, guys, one more paragraph. I'm sorry. Since starting CrossFit, I have been looking for a good post-workout recovery drink and was reminded of the Weston A. Price sports drink. The recipe calls for 8 ounces of filtered water mixed with the juice of 1 lemon, 1/4 teaspoon sea salt, 2 to 4 tablespoons whey, and 1/2 teaspoon azomite powder. Obviously, the whey would not be paleo-friendly, but I'm mainly interested in what you think of the azomite. Do you think it is safe daily or every other day consumption? Is there potentially any added benefit to post-workout supplementation of the trace minerals in the azomite in addition to electrolytes, particularly in the context of an already mineral-rich paleo diet? What would you recommend as a cheap, easy, homemade recovery drink? Looking forward to hearing your 2 cents and keep up the good work.
Dude, that was a whole podcast in one
man,
question, even though there were a lot more questions.
I don't know why I struggled so much on that one. You know what it is? It's when you have these huge paragraphs, it all just blends together while I'm trying to read it.
Yeah, it's true.
I should probably get my eyeglass prescription updated one of these days. It's only like 10 years old.
Details. So let's tackle the easy stuff. What do I recommend for a post-workout beverage? Totally depends on what your goals are. You know, we've talked about that type of stuff a ton. If you're a super hard-charging athlete and you want to do some post-workout whey or whey plus carbs, go for it. Just keep an eye on kind of inflammation and gaining fat through the midsection and all that sort of jive. I think that's kind of the outer edge of performance. You know, when you start doing that sort of stuff, I'm doing fine in old dude jujitsu, and when I get done with my session, I've got a baked yam or a sweet potato, and I've got a little hunk of chicken, and I'm doing great on that. And seems like when I start going down the road of liquid nutrition post-workout, that's when I start getting like the acne and getting a little chubby and all the rest of that. But, you know, play with it. That's kind of the, you know, either do or don't. Play with it. See what the results are. Can't say too much more than that. As to the azomite powder, I mean, honestly, Dr. Julia did a phenomenal job even delineating all the different factors here. If we have time, we're going to talk about mycotoxins in coffee here in just a little bit. And so there's definitely some, indications in the literature that some of these clays can have some, I wouldn't call them detoxification, in that the way that the hippies view this is that you've got toxins loaded in your body, and then you're going to eat some magical food and it's going to pull it out. Like our system is very good at doing that. If we eat a little bit of fiber, if we eat adequate protein so that we manufacture a glutathione and our normal, you know, different phases of the detoxification pathways in the liver functioning, like we do pretty well with that. And if you are like hammered with heavy metals, then you might seek out a functional medicine doctor and do some sort of chelation therapy to deal with that. But, you know, I mean, otherwise this detoxification thing makes me a little bit nervous because I think that people don't really get what that means and they're kind of building it up to be bigger than what it actually is. Now, if there are situations, say, like with food poisoning, we're taking charcoal, possibly taking, you know, something like this azomite powder can be really beneficial for actually binding to bacterial toxins or mycotoxins that are actively trying to make their way into your person via the gut. But that's an entirely different gig. I just want people to be really clear about that. There seems to be some benefit from this stuff with regards to like an antimicrobial effect, particularly with certain gut parasites. You know, I mean, if you think about it, if the gut parasites are used to just kind of dealing with protein, carbs, fat, and, you know, stuff swooshing through the intestinal tract, and then you get some sort of grainy, high silica content, a paste pumping through the intestines, that might actually be pretty irritating for a parasite, and that seems to be some of the indications from traditional cultures when people would use this stuff. There definitely can be situations where these minerals do have some heavy metal content. Whether or not that heavy metal would actually make its way into the system is not real clear. Like, there's just not a lot of data on that stuff. It is interesting. Like, animals, traditional cultures all seem to ferret out these beneficial clays, these beneficial soils when people need them. There's also the deal with like the homeostatic soil organisms, which is a whole other kind of topic. But you know, there might be some benefit to this, but I see it so far down the road relative to like, you know, eating a gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet, grain, legume, dairy-free, get plenty of sleep, take some probiotics, make sure your vitamin D levels are good, get some exercise. I don't really see this as being like an award winner with regards to a trace mineral supplementation standpoint. And that's just based off some of the reading that I was doing. A lot of these things actually end up being kind of poor in the, you know, like chromium or selenium and, you know, the other things that we want. I think you'd be better off just looking towards some variety in your diet to get the bulk of that stuff. And then, as far as like some specific therapeutic potential, I guess I could see that for some, you know, kind of point issues, you know, like some food poisoning or some things like that. But then beyond that, I'm just not really sure how you would tackle this stuff. I definitely don't see it as being like a daily use kind of item. Like to the degree I would use it in a very punctuated fashion. So I think Julia's description of this thing was probably better than mine was, but there's just not a ton of stuff out there other than like some very observational type things. And then it really depends on what the source of the clay is to be able to comment on, okay, this one's safe and this one's not. You know, maybe one of them has a bunch of cadmium and lead and then the other stuff doesn't. So it's really difficult to comment on the specifics because I don't know what specific clay somebody might be using.
Yeah, don't dig up the clay right next to the mine.
Or next to the gas station. That might be a bad idea.
Yes. Okay. David says, hi. Just to be clear, we rugby players consider ourselves to be real men because we don't use pads or helmets. But clearly, if I can't outsnatch the top 48-kilo women, or Greg's wife, I am not a man. I was wondering if working on my shoulder mobility so that I can snatch deep and heavy will be counterproductive towards my goal of not getting shoulder dislocations or injuries playing rugby. I just play at an amateur level and haven't had any serious shoulder injuries in the past, but here in Australia there is 110-kilo Samoan on every team. other info. Last year I got a niggling rotator cuff / front of my shoulder injury. I love that anatomical description.
Indeed.
But it went away after resting it. Currently I can power snatch, but I'm not very comfortable in the deep overhead squat position. I really want to get better at the Oli lifts with my shiny new weightlifting shoes and hopefully compete sometime soon. I've been doing mostly the power lifts for the past 18 months with lots of power cleans and snatches during rugby season last year. Stats, 171 centimeters tall, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
86 kilos, 75 kilo press, 105 kilo bench, 170 kilo squat, 185 kilo deadlift, 90 kilo power clean, 67.5 kilo power snatch. Well, Rob, do you want to kick this one off, or shall I go for it?
You know, I think one of the big questions was, would increasing shoulder mobility predispose one towards shoulder dislocation? And I would probably argue the opposite. You know,
as would I.
If you buy some normal range of movement that is healthy, then I think that you're actually going to be immunized against shoulder dislocation relative to, you know, if you're so tight, like if the, you know, the serratus and the, you know, pec minor and all that stuff are so tight that you have a very limited kind of range of normal movement, then I think the dislocation potential is much higher. This is where I really like some of the basic gymnastics stuff, like the skin the cat and front lever, back lever progressions. And this is something that I've got out of the practice of doing when we moved out of Chico, because I didn't have access to a gym every day. And I've noticed that, like, my thoracic spine isn't as mobile, my shoulders aren't as healthy, and that front lever, back lever, skin the cat stuff is just amazing for improving shoulder range of movement. You need to ease into it, and there's a bunch of other stuff that you can do in conjunction with this. But you're really strengthening both the muscles and the connective tissue through a really therapeutic full range of movement. And I think it's one of the most important things, like for me doing jiu-jitsu and constantly facing being in you know, shoulder and locks that are either an internal or external rotation lock, and to the degree that I can kind of immunize my shoulder on that, then it buys me a little bit more time fighting out of holds, and also is definitely an injury preventative. And you know, when we're working takedowns and stuff like that, if I land a little weird, then my shoulder is kind of immunized against that. So that's my thought on that stuff. Craig, what do you think in here? I definitely see a disparity in the power output given the size of this dude. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that. Improved shoulder mobility should decrease your chance of dislocation to a point. I mean, obviously, we're talking about hypermobility. You know, you want to establish that normal full range of motion and then not go beyond that. So that's an important distinction, because a lot of people have gotten super pumped on mobility lately, and to a point though that they're crossing that threshold of normal, healthy, full range of motion and going into that range of hypermobility, which is it generally, I would say, not as problematic as hypomobility, but it still presents a lot of problems. So first thing I would say after that is you shouldn't have to really get your shoulder mobility to any crazy degree. I would check, like Rob kind of alluded to, check your T-spine mobility. That's a huge one that people overlook. But then also your ankle and hip mobility. So a lot of times, and I feel like I see it more and more, people say, well, I can't do an overhead squat, or I can't snatch because my shoulder mobility isn't good enough. And I say, okay, we'll do a squat. And they can't even squat properly in a nice upright posture. And so basically what they're seeing as inadequate shoulder mobility, there might be some of that, but a huge amount of it too is coming out of their lower body. They can't even get into a squat posture that would allow them to hold the bar overhead safely and comfortably. So the point of that is check all that stuff, ankles especially, they go overlooked a lot. Get the hips mobile. Make sure you can sit into a full, deep squat with an upright chest, and then take up the slack with the shoulders. And so, again, you shouldn't be getting into any kind of hypermobility there. That should be totally normal range of motion. You should feel a lot better. And then beyond that, just make sure that you're supporting any increased mobility with increased strength and stability. So do all your rotator cuff exercises. You see, you know, you say you had a little rotator cuff thing. I don't know what exactly that was. In front of shoulder injury, you know, just wild ass guess. You probably had some bicep tendonitis, since that seems to be super, super common. And so both those things, you know, make sure you're getting the mobility work in there, but getting the strength work in there to support the joint. And then doing all your full range of motion, pressing and pulling exercises. Definitely, you know, make the pulling volume a little bit higher, if not significantly higher than your pressing volume. Especially with the weightlifting stuff, make sure you're getting some good, like, horizontal rowing movements. And then, beyond that, I mean, I would work into it real gradually. Don't expect to be snatching, you know, 150 kilos anytime soon. Work the positions first. Get really comfortable in the bottom with your overhead squats, with your snatch balance variations, all that kind of stuff before you really start pushing the snatches. And that way you're going to go into it in a more gradual, kind of conservative manner and not push it to the point of opening yourself up for potential injury and setting yourself up to get totally destroyed by 110 kilo Samoan.
Which nobody likes that.
No. No. 110 kilos is a lot of weight, no matter where it's from. Okay. Shall we? This is a would be a great one to finish an episode on.
I agree. Anything okay. with the explosive diarrhea potential is a great finish.
Okay,
it's like heavy farmer's walks. It just finishes you off right.
Oh man, Sam says, "Hey, Rob and Greg, love the podcast. I have a quick and urgent question. I was wondering what are both your thoughts on sodium bicarbonate loading leading up to a competition. I've heard that it helps to stop the production of lactic acid and, quote, engages beast mode for a short time. I've heard 300 milligrams per kilo of body weight split evenly over 3 hours leading up to the competition and workout. I've also heard that if you go about sodium bicarbonate loading incorrectly, explosive diarrhea may occur." And I like that explosive diarrhea is capitalized as a proper noun. "I CrossFit 5 times per week and have been paleo for a little over a year now with great results. While I'm comfortable around my fellow athletes, I'd really rather not have any problems with anything being explosive whilst in the gym, or at all for that matter. Your help is much appreciated, guys. P.S. I don't know how long it may take for this question to be answered, so I may just go for it. If you see an awesome YouTube video of a guy shitting himself during Clean and Jerks, I did it wrong."
Are there any other types of videos?
Seriously. Oh, man.
Maybe I'm navigating to the wrong stuff, but the sodium bicarb loading, just as an aside, this was a fantastic reader submission. We should start doing some sort of reward for the outstanding reader submission of the week. We'll have to give that some thought, but
we'll send this guy a big box of diapers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be situation specific, but based on need, the sodium bicarbonate loading, like, it definitely can improve performance, typically in more aerobic or kind of anaerobic activity, you know, like a anaerobic interval type stuff. I wouldn't see much benefit from like a weightlifting kind of, you know, powerlifting. I wouldn't see any benefit from doing it in that situation. It's definitely buffering the pH change in a muscle. It's not specific to just lactic acid, but just general hydrogen ion accumulation that happens in the cellular matrix and can start impeding muscle contraction. The deal with this stuff, there's two pieces. One is that if you overdo the intake, I see it more as explosive vomiting, like projectile vomiting is what I've seen in the literature more so than the explosive diarrhea, but...
Hey, what's more intimidating to your competition than explosive vomiting?
Really, that's getting your game face on. There's no doubt about that. So maybe it's not a problem, but that is a potential on this stuff. If you overdo the dose, then you've got that problem. The other side of this is that when we think about the training stimulus, part of what is the bicarbonate is doing is buffering the pH change, which is actually a major driver of that hormetic stress that causes an adaptation. So you don't want to use this stuff as a general purpose supplement because you're actually blunting the adaptation to the stress. This is the reason why taking really high dose antioxidants or vitamins right around training is a bad idea. It seems like coffee and green tea and stuff like that is fine, because those things act as hormetic stressors themselves, and although they may be quenching some free radical activity, it's not doing it in a way like taking a big dose of vitamin C is just basically neutralizing all free radical activity or like the bulk of the free radical activity. So you need to be really clear about what you're doing with this, because if you overdose on the bicarbonate, or if you use this too frequently, you're actually going to impede progress because you're not getting a stimulus. If you want to use it for an event, then that's an entirely different story. But then you obviously need to field test this stuff enough to know what the appropriate dosage is, what this does with regards to like fluid, you know, balance, GI status, and all the rest of that stuff. So the back and forth that you're going to play with this is that you are going to burn some of your training sessions learning how you can use this, and they're not really going to be productive from an adaptation standpoint. And this is, I think, a large part of why the bicarbonate, like, it was real hot, I don't know, God, like 15 years ago, 12 to 15 years ago.
Yeah, I remember this being all the rage, like, with rock climbers and stuff.
Yeah,
many moons ago.
And then almost nobody uses it anymore. So I see this a little bit like the caffeine ephedrine, you know, the ECA stack. Which was awesome. It seemed like a really good idea, but then at the end of the day, the collateral damage and side effects are not really all that great. So that's kind of my big picture thing on this. It might be beneficial for an event. You need to figure out how to use it for the event. In the process of figuring out how to use it, you're burning some of your training adaptation. And then at the end of the day, if your fluid status that day is off, if you... you know, if some little parameter changes, then what was a safe dose for you the other day on game day, it may be the thing that gives you the trots, or you end up vomiting everywhere. So, I don't know. What is it? Caveat impetor or whatever? You know, buyer beware. I would use this with reservation, and I think that there's a lot of other things.
DMG, dimethylglycine, can kind of enhance oxygen transport. Cordyceps is kind of an adaptogenic mushroom extract. I think there's a lot of other things that could get some legitimate mileage out of your training versus the bicarbonate gig. So,
All right. Well, I feel like we answered some questions today.
We did. We did.
And I think I learned something. Not sure what yet. I'm sure it'll sink in.
I think you learned that you want to move your coffee pot to within arm's reach of the of the place where you're working. So
certainly true.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got too much other stuff over here.
Sweet.
So,
all right, man.
Any new projects will be out besides the website?
We've got the website. We have the budget ebook that's going to come out, and that thing is actually
there we go.
Yeah. Thanks for the prompt on that. Amber had an idea about, you know, addressing this whole, like, paleo was expensive gig. And I did a blog post on that. And, you know, it's one of these things a little bit like saturated fat. Like, it just never goes away no matter how much data you put to the contrary. So we started working on this budget ebook, and it ended up being this massive project. Like, it has cooking techniques, how to use a pressure cooker, how to use slow cooker, knife cutting, you know, techniques for cutting veggies and meat, and how to shop, what the preferred cuts of meat are. It's not just localized to the U.S. Like, we've kind of addressed some more global markets and everything. I think it's really solid. And so that should be rolling out with the new website. We're still hashing away on the details of the certification that we've got rolling out. But it looks like we are going to have a legit academic wing to this. Like, it looks like when people do the certification, we're going to have probably an evolutionary studies minor as a part of that, in addition to like the nutritional biochemistry and pathophysiology and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of looking like we're going to have three different flavors to it, probably something for the general public, which is more a tell me a little bit about this stuff and then how to actually, you know, eat paleo and implement it. And then we're going to have two other flavors, one for kind of strength coaches, trainers, maybe kind of nurse, physical therapy area, and then the other piece is going to be more like MDs, DOs, researchers. Obviously, folks can kind of take any of those, but the higher level course is going to be very, very demanding. Like, if you don't have a good steeping in a, you know, biochemistry, pathophysiology, basic cell biology and everything, like, if you don't have a basic biology or biochemistry background, you're gonna have a rough time in there. So anyway,
are you telling me my English degree will not prepare me for this?
Well, the fact that you're a genius might actually buffer you a little bit, but if it was me with an English background, I would be
Rob, I barely know what cells are, so
well.
I'll argue that. But that's the other stuff that we have cooking. Like we're getting the details on all that hammered out. Gosh, there's some talk behind the scenes related to the Ancestral Health Symposium folks and the Paleo Physician Network trying to get some formalized kind of governing body dealing with that. There's a lot of good stuff going on, like just a ton of really good stuff, and just trying to keep all the plates spinning. And then amidst doing all that, screaming towards having a kid. So we'll see how productive I am after the kid arrives. So trying to get all this stuff done before that happens, and then I can be on coast mode for a couple of months while we're dealing with the little one arriving. So
it's going to be a good lesson in time management.
Indeed it is. And I've already been paring back my Facebook stuff a lot. The switch on Facebook to the new timeline made it easy for me to just extract myself out of there. So,
yes.
Yeah. So cool. Yeah, that's what I've got cooking. And then we have the Pocket Greg Everett available. So folks, check that out. And I know you guys are doing some site updating and everything. So we'll just keep folks posted on the new stuff as they roll out.
Cool.
Sweet.
All right.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
See ya.